This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Inside Story on BFM 89.9.
Good evening. You're listening to Inside Story with Lee Chui Lin and Shamla Ganesan. Today, we are marking the International Day of Sport for Development and Peace.
First, we talk about the spirit of this day and the role of sports in fostering relationships between people and countries. Then, we speak with the Rohingya Football Club about how the game has created a sense of community for its members.
So, basically, we want to know, do you think sports does actually bring us all together, and what are your favourite sports to watch? You can call us 7733-2900. WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is 6:08, and as we've mentioned today, we are marking the International Day of Sport for Development and Peace, which falls on April 6th every year. In case you're wondering, it's related to the Olympics. We'll get there shortly. But yeah, essentially, what it aims to do is acknowledge the positive role that sports plays in promoting peace and harmony between communities, in creating community development and change. And this year, specifically, they're looking at securing a sustainable and peaceful future for all, the contribution of sport, with a primary focus on addressing the climate crisis and lowering greenhouse gas emissions.
So if you're wondering how all of this came about, the 6th of April actually marks the day of the first ever modern Olympics that formally opened in Athens, Greece in 1896. And in 2013, the UN General Assembly essentially declared this event, and it's been celebrated from 2014 onwards. And the reason for this is also because sport was officially included in the UN's 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. And then in 2015, global leaders adopted it as an important enabler for sustainable development. Now, that's not to say everything the UN does necessarily pans out the way they would like it to, but worth looking at what that agenda means, because essentially they're talking about sports and you know, the various sports' ability to empower women, young people, individuals, communities, as well as advancing health, education, and social inclusion.
Okay, I have a couple of things to say. I think that it's important to acknowledge that sports on its own clearly does all these things. It clearly brings people together. It is an important way to foster not just health, but also things like leadership. It's often talked about as an important element in terms of teaching children these things, right? And fostering that from a young age. A love of sport clearly brings hundreds of thousands of people together every week, more or less, in a variety of spaces around the world. And so I don't think there's any denying the important role of sport itself, and how loving sports and harnessing that love of sport can clearly lead to all these things that we're talking about. Now, the flip side of that is that there's a reason why most sport fans love the game, whatever your game may be, and dislike the associations, that the governing bodies. They are not popular, generally speaking, with anybody. And in fact, I think, broadly speaking as well, governments and the ways that they utilize sports often criticized. So you have all that. You also have the issue of sports washing, this idea that countries, particularly authoritarian ones, use sports as a means to say everything is fine, to basically get in there under the umbrella of positivity and good vibes that sports can create. So it's a number of different things. And I feel like when we talk about something like this in a scale as large as a United Nations Day, it's quite complicated.
The example that comes to mind for me is really when we talk about loving film or loving movies versus the Hollywood system, because those are actually two distinct things, right? The system is governed by commercial interests, capitalism, the need to maintain an industry, whereas the love for film is something a lot more internal and a lot more driven by emotions. And I think that with sports, the other aspect that comes alongside this is, of course, you cannot remove the fact that it is competitive. And therefore, when you play that out across a national stage or even on a person-to-person level, you get issues of things like abuse or exploitation or this notion of what it means when someone's an athlete, what position do they occupy in the national imagination. So there are lots of challenges, I think, when it comes to saying, or rather it's an oversimplification when we say, the sports has great capacity to foster peace or to foster relationships. It is true on some levels. On other levels, though, it can also be quite problematic. But I do think that it's worth looking at those two things. And perhaps the former can actually help us be better with the latter.
So we're going to start off by examining, the issues that we've been talking about and the role that sports can actually play in something like development and peace, and also some of the more problematic aspects of running with that. We'd like to hear from you. Do you think that sports actually brings us all together, promotes these things, promotes social ties? What are your favorite sports to watch, and what are some of the issues that you're aware of with them? You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018 789 8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us after this to dissect this thing is Dr. James Dorsey, Senior Fellow at the Middle East Institute in the National University of Singapore. Keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Break from mediocrity. BFM 89.9.
It is 6:15 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. And today we are looking at, and I guess kind of taking apart in some ways, the International Day of Sport for Development and Peace, which is a day declared by the UN. And we will be talking about that in more detail. We'd like to hear from you, though. Do you think that sports does actually bring us all together? And what are some of your favorite sports to watch? You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018 789 8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us now is Dr. James Dorsey, Senior Fellow at the Middle East Institute in the National University of Singapore. James, thank you so much for speaking with us. So to start us off, as we said, today is the International Day of Sport for Development and Peace. From your perspective, what role has sports played in furthering elements of community development and social change?
Well, in terms of social change and in terms of community development, a lot. I mean, you know, development of women's sports, community activities, and so on and so forth. I think when you get to the elite level, which is what a lot of people look at, so with other words, the role of sports in diplomacy, the role in sports in determining relations between countries, I think there you get a much more mixed bag, whereby in principle, the cases where sports really had an impact, a lasting impact, are very few and far between. There are many more moments where either a momentary event created some degree of unity or forged a bridge, only to be fall apart very quickly after that. And so I think sports, and particularly football, can be very divisive.
That's it. How have we perhaps seen governments making use of sports to strengthen social ties in their countries? Are there examples that might stand out to you?
I think, look, as a matter of principle, I think every country does that in the sense, let's face it, sports is crucial to many aspects of education, of society. It's crucial to public health. So in that sense, in terms of sports and its role in domestic policies and domestic society, in the welfare of communities or the welfare of certain social groups, for example, women or minorities or those that are disabled, for example. I think there you see a broad palette of where sports is playing a very important and a positive role.
How has sports also played a role in diplomacy and relationships between countries?
Well, I mean, go back to the famous ping pong games in the 1970s between the United States and China, which was the way that Nixon sort of opened a road towards diplomacy with China, or opened a door. That may be as far as it goes. Imagine a situation in which Nixon would not have accepted the one policy China. One China policy at the time, sports wouldn't have made a difference and you would have had a failed contact. I think more recently what you're seeing is not so much sports as a diplomatic tool, to create a contact. Everybody has contact with everybody in one form or another, even if you don't have diplomatic relations. We saw that with the agreements with Israel and the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan. It's become much more a tool of branding, of trying to position a country. It's become a tool of branding. You see that with Qatar with the World Cup. You see that with other countries in the Gulf trying to host Saudi Arabia, the UAE. But again, that's a double-edged sword, because what it means is it's putting yourself out on the line, which also means you open yourself up for criticism.
Are some sports more conducive than others in furthering the goals that this day is meant to achieve, particularly because of their popularity?
That's certainly true for football. Football obviously is the most popular form of popular entertainment. 5% of the world's population is engaged in football in one way or another. So by definition, it's football. Now, there are, of course, cricket is in some parts of the world the most popular sport. And in those parts of the world, you know, particularly original former British colonies, whether it's Pakistan, Australia, South Africa, Britain itself, of course, again, in Britain, I would guess that football tops cricket, even if, Britain is a major cricket country. And you see that that's where the emphasis has been. You don't see big name tennis players being bought. You don't see cricket clubs being bought by a country, but you do see very major European soccer teams being bought by wealthy individuals or wealthy countries.
I will say that the second half of our interview is likely to be a little more critical of this issue of sports and the role that it can play in all of this. And I wanted to start, I guess, by looking at football, in fact, as a microcosm, because if, you know, as we are saying, it is the most popular sport and therefore one in which we can see a number of both the biggest positives as well as the biggest negatives. What would you say are some of the major things that we can learn from football in the ways in which it has been, as you referenced earlier, divisive or a place in which we have seen some ethical issues come up?
Well, I think what we've seen is that and if you go back to, for example, the 2008 Iraqi winning of the Asian Football Club. Here you had a situation, it was almost classic, amid a civil war, basically. A Kurd passes a ball to a Shiite who shoots a ball into a Sunni-defended goal, and the country, they win the Asian Football Club a day after 50 people die in a bombing of football fans. And everybody's out in the streets hugging each other. And 24 hours later, they're out in the streets killing each other, and they do so for several years on. And the same has happened with, you go back to 2014, the Christmas ceasefire between Britain and Germany to play a soccer match. And they play the soccer match, and then you have a world war for 4 years. So, with other words, it's a very momentary effect that you can get. What we're also now seeing is that you take the case of Qatar. And it's for the last decade been preparing for the World Cup. Those have not been 10 years of being feasted by the international community for having been so successful in winning the World Cup. Those have been 10 years of severe criticism and Qatar having to, and rightfully so, introduce reforms in order to really get the benefit, the reputational benefit, of hosting the World Cup.
So the term that has come up quite a bit is sports washing, right? What's your take on this? Which countries have been particularly adept at it?
Well, first of all, the term that I have used, and I think it's more accurate, is reputation laundering. So with other words, what have we seen? We've seen countries like the United Arab Emirates or Qatar purchase high-profile soccer clubs. Now, there's a difference between the UAE and Qatar. So in the case of the UAE, they bought Manchester City, and they used that for two purposes. One, to enhance their reputation, to distract attention from parts of their reputation that has drawn negative comment, including human rights. But they've also used it as a commercial base to launch a global franchise with clubs. They forged a relationship with China, and China has become a shareholder in this. And they have football clubs in Australia and the United States and Latin America. What you're seeing with Qatar is, again, it is reputational, but it's part of a much more fundamental strategy that, on the one hand, was geared towards the rivalry and the animosity and hostility that we've had for several years between Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, which spilled out in multiple fields overseas. But it's also part of a much more fundamental strategy to make sports a pillar of the economy as well as of national identity.
So, you know, we have spoken to you many times about the intersection between sports and politics. And most recently, we've seen Russia excluded from a number of major sports, including being suspended from the World Cup and club competitions, dropped from the F1 roster. What effect do actions like these have in the larger geopolitical movements around the invasion of Ukraine?
Well, I think it raises very problematic issues. As a matter of principle, by doing this, international sports associations can no longer claim that sports and politics are separate, because this is a political move by definition. And so the consequence of this should be really a fundamental debate and discussion within the international sports world, as well as on a national basis, on, you know, what are the parameters of this relationship and how do you govern that relationship? Now, I also think there's another issue here, which is, you know, do you penalize individual athletes for their opinions? So obviously, I'm a firm opponent of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but it's a Russian athlete right to be in support of that. I may fundamentally disagree with it, but as much as I don't want to be banned from whatever it may be because I'm against something, can I allow someone else to be banned because they're in favor of it? So, with other words, this raises very fundamental questions, and I don't know that we're even starting to address those questions.
James, we have about a minute left. What would you like to leave us with?
Well, I think the most important message here is that sports and politics are Siamese twins. They're joined at the hips, they're inseparable, and it's a reality. The sooner we recognize that reality, the better it is, and the easier it's going to be to try and find a way of governing that relationship.
James, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. James Dorsey, Senior Fellow at the Middle East Institute in the National University of Singapore, speaking to us about the International Day of Sport for Development and Peace, but I think more critically, taking a look at what the day means and what it aims to achieve and the role that sports actually plays in all of this, which leads us to our question. We've been asking you, do you think sports does actually bring us all together, and what are your favourite sports to watch? You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back to continue the conversation. Keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Banish fraudulent maneuvers, BFM 89.9.
It is 6:37 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. And today we are marking, and more accurately dissecting, the International Day of Sport for Development and Peace, which purports to acknowledge the positive role that sport plays in promoting peace and harmony between communities. As we established earlier, because sport is a worldwide industry, because it is a huge money-making endeavor, it's not that simple. It's not like we're just talking about children playing in the park. And so because of that, it is by necessity kind of a complicated conversation. But we've been asking you, so do you think that sports actually does bring us all together? And what are some of your favorite sports to watch? You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. Before we get to our next guest, we do have some messages.
I want to say broadly, so far our messages are not really getting into the spirit of the day and instead seem also more interested in dissecting the issue.
So they're getting into the spirit of the show, not the day.
Okay, KW says, what's good in sports when we have countries who do everything, including not so nice things to win a competition, like cheating, doping, and the latest, which is accepting frogs to represent the country, frogs that were trained by another country using public funds. I'm not sure I love the use of the word frogs because, I mean, the athletes, I assume, would go where they're taken care of.
Mm.
But yes, I think that there are these sorts of practices that really don't give sports a great name.
Yes, and again, it comes back to that push and pull between when is it an athlete who is... When are we critiquing athletes versus when are we critiquing systems?
Yes.
And I don't want to say, so for example, do I have tremendous issues? Here I go asking myself rhetorical questions like a professional journalist. No, but I mean, do I have issues with the OIC or perhaps with how the Olympics are run? Do I have issues with FIFA and how the World Cup might be run? Of course. Do I nevertheless cry at, you know, major Olympic moments or find myself swept up in the drama of it all when somebody is on the final leg, when the World Cup final rolls around, when there is that one story of somebody who made it all the way there? You know, of course, all these things still matter. And so I think it's kind of a difficult one when we talk about sport. What are we even talking about? And I don't think that that's an easy answer.
So the idea of separating the athlete from the systems and the sports is something that Angie, who called earlier, brings up. Also something that our guest earlier talked about. So Angie says, about sports as a uniting factor, how is it that sports has been used to sanction Russia? During the Winter Olympics, Russia was banned from competing because of the situation with Ukraine. If sports is used to bring the world together, why are Americans and NATO using sports to disallow Russian athletes? Leave sports alone, don't use it in politics. Now, I think wherever you fall in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the point that that our guest earlier, Dr. James Dorsey, raised was, I think, a great one, right? The notion of sanctioning someone for their beliefs or sanctioning someone for what they might stand for actually is a slippery slope, because what you sanction for really depends on what you believe in.
That's the thing. And also, so I would say, leave sports alone, don't use it in politics. What we heard James say earlier is essentially that it's too late for that, that it was always political, that if you think about it in the context of the Olympics and the truce, which is when it was first, you know, when it first came about also, even then it was already political. And I think that there are many moments in which athletes make it political too, and that's fine. I think what the issue is that we're not seeing governing bodies or countries regulating and managing that well. In other words, that there is no acknowledgement that decisions that are made are inherently political in nature. And because there is no acknowledgement, so it all feels somewhat disingenuous, which is where we get messages like this. However, I also agree that sanctioning athletes on a personal level is tough. And in some cases, they've sanctioned athletes for not even for outright saying anything. It's purely because of nationality, and that's even tougher.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it, right? An athlete isn't always open about their political beliefs. One might well belong to a nation and not subscribe to what the nation stands for or the ideology. And so, yes, it does feel like a particularly unfair way to hold a country to task by punishing its citizens.
In closing, for now at least, we have Kamar Nizam, who says, sports are like nationality, race, political parties and religion. They unite us, then divide us from one another. We love football, but then we have teams we support diehards. We're Malaysians, but then we're Sabahan, Sarawakian, etc. We're one race, but we have different dialects. We believe in God, but we have different gods. At the end of the day, people always unite to fight one another.
Oh, that's a little cynical, isn't it? But I mean, not untrue. As someone who sometimes can get quite cynical about this, I think about this a lot when, on the one hand, football is referred to as the beautiful game, and then on the other hand, you have fans beating up other fans because they won or lost.
So it's all sides of the coin, right? Like, can I appreciate when a Liverpool player does something amazing? Of course I can, because I love football. Does it mean I love the club? No. And so I think it's those kinds of things, right, where you can love a sport and a game. You can be divided by clubs and that kind of you know, who it is that you swear allegiance to, it doesn't have to end in a riot outside a stadium. So,
you know, hope not. Yes.
Yes. Keep those thoughts coming. We've been talking today about whether sports does actually bring us all together and what are some of your favorite sports to watch. You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018 789 8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. And now I think acknowledging the role that sports can play in creating a sense of community, especially for us, for a people that aren't necessarily, I think, that find it difficult, through no fault of their own, to find a home in Malaysia, right? Because we're going to be talking about the Rohingya community and where football comes into play. Joining us to talk about this is Muhammad Noor, who is the chairman as well as co-founder of the Rohingya Football Club, or RFC. Muhammad Noor, thank you so much for joining us. So tell us about Rohingya FC. How did it come about and when?
Rohingya FC, which is RFC for short, Rohingya Football Club, started back in 2017 from Kuala Lumpur, with an hope that how can we create a national team for Rohingya that can play at least on a national level. So that's what was the idea. Then later on, we have managed to escalate all the way to CANIFA. CANIFA is an alternative to FIFA for de facto nation, stateless people, and so on. So we are one of the team there in CANIFA. Today, we have more than 8 football teams all around the world that are starting from Malaysia to Bangladesh, Saudi Arabia, Canada, and Australia, wherever Rohingya are now in diaspora. This is all about, but ultimately to tell our side of the story, the Rohingya persecution through the art of the football. That was the whole idea, because Rohingya has been introduced as a victim of genocide, which is also true. But we also want to bring Rohingya, if given chances, Rohingya also have talent. They also can play. They can all be to be shoulder to shoulder, and not only burden, but can be a sense of joy and happiness as well.
Who are your players? How did you go about recruiting them?
So normally our players are from like 17 to 18 all the way to 35. And since Rohingyas are, most of them are refugee, a lot of them works in as a grass cutter. Some of them as a vegetable sellers. Some of them are just a normal general workers. So anyone who is young and who have a desire to play football, and most importantly, desire to represent the community, not only in Malaysia, but across the world. So that's how we choose our players.
And when you were first starting the club, was there a lot of enthusiasm from the community? Did a lot of people want to join?
Yes, yes, of course. I mean, long before even RFC started, there was a lot of teams in different parts of Malaysia, in Selayang, in Ampang, even in Subang, and across not only in KL, but also in Johor Bahru, in Kelantan, and many others. Similarly, also in Bangladesh, Cox's Bazar, in different camps as well, in Saudi Arabia. So we decided to put these things in a more professional way, more organized way, in a team manner, with proper suits, with proper jerseys, and so on. And with, most importantly, with a mission and vision that all came together. And all everything you know came in a place where now things are happening, where we have been recognized across the world, and so on. So from the beginning, people were very, very excited. And what we did as a co-founder is to bring all this excitement into a context. Rather than just playing for fun, we wanted to bring this not only for fun, also for recognition, also for unity, and so on.
Tell us about the kinds of matches you play. Have there been any standout moments?
Yes, we have. Before COVID in Malaysia, we had played a Rohingya tournament, and where more than 22 Rohingya teams from across Malaysia, from Kelantan, Terengganu, Johor Bahru, and many other places, came down to Kuala Lumpur. And then it was also helped by a lot of local people and authorities as well, played in a normal field where there's a lot of spectator. We have expected like more than 5,000 Rohingya actually came to see the game, and local Malaysians were part of it as well. And we have distributed a lot of medals. Not only that, also we have distributed cups and so on. during that event, the member of Khanifa from Germany came down to KL and distributed some jersey and gave some recognition. And it was came in different magazines and so on. So for being Rohingya, not being recognized, to get a recognition in magazine, to get recognition by local, to get recognition by local football, like Malaysian football teams and so on. So it's a great achievement and joy. Not only for us, for entire community, not even in Malaysia, not Rohingya in Malaysia, but also Rohingya in Cox's Bazar, in Bangladesh, and many other. It's a extreme source of happiness and joy.
And what are some of the main challenges that you and the club have faced?
Being Rohingya, of course, if we talk about the team in Malaysia only, we have logistic issues because some of them do not have a refugee card. Some of them have refugee. But when you have logistic coming down from Kelantan or Terengganu coming play over there, so that is one huge issue in terms of authorities and so on, in terms of documentation. And we also do not recommend or, you know, tell people that, you know, do not violate any law, so that if you get any into trouble, so you don't come. And so on. But along other, of course, being refugees, financially is another issue. Supporting the team with jersey, with football field rentals, and many other activities that we do, and so on. But mainly for the player themselves, because most of them are working not like from a good well-to-do family. Most of them are grass cutters, vegetable sellers, and so on. So for them to keep up their own work and also come and join here, you know, as a volunteer, because we do not pay salary to anyone. So these are all challenges after challenges, but we try to put all the gap together and try to play for not only for fun, but also to get a global recognition.
We're speaking today with Mohammad Noor, chairman and co-founder of the Rohingya Football Club, or RFC. We're going to continue our conversation after this about essentially how the club has contributed to a sense of belonging and community. We'd like to hear from you, though. We are observing the International Day for Sports and Development. And essentially, do you think that sports does bring us all together? And what are some of your favourite sports to watch? You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bruce Freddie Morrissey, BFM 89.9.
It is 6:52 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. We've been talking today about sports and how it can contribute to, I guess, you know, the development of ties in the community, how it can lead to growth, different things like that. And we've been asking you for your thoughts. We are now, though, speaking, or rather continuing our conversation with Mohammad Noor, chairman and co-founder of the Rohingya Football Club, in the spirit of talking about fostering that sense of community. So, Mohammad Noor, we know that it isn't always easy to be a Rohingya person in Malaysia. How does sports and football help to create a sense of belonging?
I mean, first of all, being a Rohingya in Malaysia is way better than many other places, of course, especially in Myanmar, which is people have been burned down and so on and so on, so forth. But we still tell Rohingya community in Malaysia who been living in Malaysia, whether they face any kind of trouble in terms of legal issues or maybe livelihood and many other issues. But it's still being Rohingya Football Club, what we can bring on the table is, as you have mentioned, is communicating with local, playing with locals and exchanging our players with them and understanding what Rohingya does. Rohingya is not only just a refugee, it is just our circumstances who made us like that, unfortunately. But we have many different players. So during one of the, I just wanted to share, during one of the match with local team, there are many different teams from Selangor and all, not Rohingya team, but Malaysian teams. When they realized within our teams, and then we started to communicate, we have people who are like 35 and 40 around that, where national players in Arakan, in Burma, they came down here as refugees. They got medal on a national level. So they were really, really impressed by seeing all this portfolio. They said, we have never thought that Rohingya, we all thought that they are just refugee. They have no skills, but it seems like you guys have skills. And when we play, some of them are really, really play well. So all those has made a lot of, you know, to fill a lot of gaps and bring a lot of understanding together. Point out a few examples, and many of those examples still exist. Many local NGOs help us into, you know, putting the game together, and even communities, even local authorities. Whenever we go for permission from the local authorities, police, to ask for permission, you know, to have a gathering, easily they give, because they know this is a very healthy activity, sports, and so on. Sometimes we go for many different places for renting the field, so they also give us the field sometime. So there's a lot of cooperation happens when you have such a especially sports activity rather than any other activities.
And how has the pandemic affected your activities? How has it changed the way you operate or run things?
I mean, pandemic has hit not only Rohingya, but all globally, down to all the way to us, Rohingya community, and especially those players are, as I told, that most of them are, you know, in working adults. So they are working here and there. They are not a full-time professional players. So their job has been affected. Their work has been affected. So during the pandemic, it is also restricted to gather and so on. So it was really, really badly affected. And many people, we had a lot of pressure of calls. They said, we don't have a job now. We don't have work. We are really stressed out. Can we play football? I said, there is the only one thing we cannot do now. We cannot gather because it's against the law. So so that's has really affected us. And also, but now since things are opening it up now, but I think that we used to have a frequency of at least one game at least in a week, but we are trying to bring that up now. Things are changing, but during the pandemic, things were quite bad, unfortunately, in terms of a livelihood, in terms of game, in terms of communicating with people, and people were really, really demotivated, and so on. And thank God, the time has passed now. But things are getting back to normal.
We have a couple of minutes left with you. Moving forward, what else do you hope to achieve with RFC?
What we have achieved so far is, like, you know, number one, getting a recognition on a world stage in a Khanifa. And we have been also sponsored by the Australian Immigration and Australian Embassy in Kuala Lumpur. And we have been also part of the SDG in the UN Sustainable Development Goal and so on. But what we want to hope to achieve now is actually to play a Refugee World Cup with the Rohingya team against other nations. Hoping if it is not a World Cup, maybe there's another cup, which is an Asian Cup, but different teams from Asia all around. It might happen in Japan or Korea to set the team, but it's also, of course, a lot of obstacles. Moving refugee from one country to another needs a lot of logistics and other documentation, travel, and so on. So, but that's what we are hoping. And most importantly, plan for this year, for 2022, is to put all our team, at least 8 teams all around the world, to give them and supply them jerseys and all the other kits that they require, and give them full training. At least by 2024 or 25, we can play Asia Cup or a World Cup. That is the tentative plan.
Mohammed Noor, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Mohammed Noor, chairman and co-founder of the Rohingya Football Club, or RFC, and, you know, talking really about the work they do and how wonderful that is. We'd like to hear from you. We've been talking today about the International Day of Sport for Development and Peace. And do you think that sports does actually bring us all together, or is it more divisive than otherwise? And what are your favourite sports to watch? You can call us, WhatsApp us, tweet us. You've been listening to Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.